From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, gunfire in Canada's capital, Ebola in New York City, the midterm money push, Ben Bradley is dead. On Wednesday in Ottawa, a wild scene as a lone gunman exchanged fire with police deep in Canada's Parliament building after killing a soldier. Ebola confirmed yesterday in New York by the mayor of New York.
We want to state at the outset there is no reason for New Yorkers to be alarmed.
And billionaire millions pouring into midterm campaign ads. Here's a Koch Brothers ad in hard-fought Kansas.
The future of Kansas, of our country, could depend on you. Kansas can stop Harry Reid and Barack Obama's failed policies.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Joining us from New York is Diane Brady, senior editor and content chief at Bloomberg Businessweek, a natural-born Canadian, now an American too. Diane Brady, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And from Washington, Kelly O'Donnell joins us, chief congressional correspondent for NBC News, all over the White House dogs and midterm politics on her Twitter feed this week. Kelly O'Donnell, welcome. It's great to have you.
Always good to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Diane, and Kelly.
The sound here of thunderous applause for the sergeant-at-arms who took down the shooter in Canada. Parliament saying thanks right there, and the Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper saying Wednesday in an address, Canada vowed a tough and uncompromising response to the attack.
We will not be intimidated. Canada will never be intimidated. In fact, this will lead us to strengthen our resolve and redouble our efforts and those of our national security agencies to take all necessary steps to identify and counter threats and keep Canada safe here at home.
Diane Brady, let me come first to you with this. I know you're not a national security expert, but just the image of a gunman in the Canadian Parliament and deep in the Parliament, I think I heard just a doorway away from the Prime Minister himself. How is this hitting Canadians? How did you see this, Diane?
It is scary. It is not the first time that we've had certainly terrorist activity. I think that what's interesting is that it happened 2 days after another convert, I guess you'd say, did a hit and run against another soldier, essentially, in Quebec. So I think it was the 1-2 punch that really frightened people a lot as well. So I think that taken together, it was scary. What's scary now, I think, is partly the reaction of Harper's government. There's been a lot of talk in Canada, and I think it's a good place to focus of more surveillance. And is that the right reaction to somebody who essentially appears to be a petty criminal who was mentally ill and took this up as a cause?
Had converted to Islam, changed his name from Michael Joseph Hall to Michael Zahaf Bibeau. Here's a Canadian on the street. This was in Ottawa, BBC, talking with a one woman surprised. What? This is happening in Canada?
I've always thought Canada to be a very peaceful and neutral country. I mean, I've obviously grown up here, born and raised here, so you don't expect anything like this to happen.
Shocking video and sound, Kelly, out of Ottawa, the Canadian capital this week. Shocking just how deep into the Parliament building this shooter got, though. We all saw the White House intruder, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, very deep there. How's Washington taking on board what they're seeing across the border here in Canada, Kelly?
Well, certainly on Capitol Hill, where there are armed U.S. Capitol Police in a very open campus, it is a question about how open do we want these public spaces to be. Most of the Washington buildings that have federal business, you can't get in very easily. But the U.S. Capitol is different because it is a place where lots of tourists from all over the country and around the world are able to visit. Now, there are mags that you go through and there are levels of screening, but it is essentially an open place. And I think when you have an incident like what we saw in Canada, it again reminds people how real the threat is, how effectively simple it could be. One man could cause so much damage, heartache, and loss, and it's unpredictable. You just don't know when it's going to happen. And so there is a sense of how can they try to respond in a way that is measured and does still look to the openness that you want in some sorts of federal buildings, but also the vigilance. And I think it's just a very painful reminder of how easily something like that can happen.
Kelly, I worked on Capitol Hill long ago as a young man, and my memory of it was just people wandering in and out. It was quite wonderful in that way. I wonder now, Kelly, how do members of Congress think about this, House and Senate? What's the chatter you hear? We want more security, or we just don't want to be that way?
I think most people do not want to have more security. They want to make sure the security that exists is as effective as possible to not keep people away, because the whole idea is that it is supposed to be a place that welcomes the public. And many people don't realize most members of Congress don't have any personal security. There are U.S. Capitol Police on detail, but only certain members who are in leadership or have high committee positions actually have a personal detail like we see with the president. So there is a vulnerability, but also members of Congress have to be accessible to their constituents. And so it is striking the balance. I think there is a sense of, are there enough resources? Are there enough personnel? I was on Capitol Hill earlier in the week when right after this happened, and there was certainly a sense, even among the U.S. Capitol Police officers, of that, wow, I can't believe that happened. And a reminder of the vigilance here. If you come to the U.S. Capitol, you will see weapons displayed to show that force, to deter. But it's also a place where people do want to come, and there are thousands of visitors who walk through those halls. So I think it's something that has caused people concern, but I don't think there will be any immediate changes.
Diane, I heard you there.
Well, one thing I think is interesting is, first of all, you want kids to visit the White House.
Sure.
You want kids to visit Parliament. U.S. officials are apparently debating whether or not to tighten controls on the border and revoke passports and the like. I think that the danger here is an overreaction, because I recall, you know, that was it the flight right after 2 months after 9/11, where the immediate gut reaction was this must somehow be tied to terrorism. And, you know, there was this immediate assumption somehow that this was very much linked to what was going on over, in Syria and such. And I think that that's one of the dangers, is that these are two isolated incidents. They're tragic. But should we be stepping up essentially what's already been considered problematic for people, which is more surveillance, more controls?
Jack, the Canadian Prime Minister went right to the word terrorism and didn't seem reluctant to link this to some larger threat.
No, he didn't. And, you know, David Brooks has suggested that the media block out coverage of outrages like this, which, in his view, spread what 19th century anarchists call propaganda by deed to the alienated, borderline, rational copycat terrorists like these young men. You know, we can't do that, but he undoubtedly has a point. On the other hand, our own actions abroad spread propaganda. Our deeds include bombing 14 Muslim countries since 1980. Barack Obama is the fourth straight U.S. president to bomb Iraq. Syria is the seventh predominantly Muslim country he's bombed since 2009. A Gallup poll of 65,000 people in 65 countries last year found that we're considered the greatest threat to peace in the world today by far, by a large measure. None of this justifies any of that, but it does point to the context here of self-radicalization. These self-radicals have something to be radicalized about.
Keep an eye on perceptions all over the world. Let's hear from Toronto, Canada. Ed is calling. Hi, Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Tom. It seems our Canadian Prime Minister is going through a George Bush moment of glory, a vainglorious moment like George Bush had in 2001. In our case, our parliament was very divided about going to war against ISIS, and now everybody's, including the opposition parties, are rallying around the prime minister, rallying around the flag. So it's all the way. We're now on the front lines of the war against terror, and I'm a little bit concerned because I travel in these parts of the world with a Canadian passport, and like many Canadians, we may become targets.
In the coalition, and how tightly it's related, there's the attack. Ed, thank you for your call in Toronto. One more here from Ontario. Mo, you're on the air, Mo.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just want to say that what happened the other day is terrible. As a person from Middle Eastern descent and a Muslim,
yes,
there's nothing to be proud of, killing an unarmed soldier who's standing as an honor guard at a monument. I mean, it's an awful, awful thing that happened.
Yes.
But what your guest said just a moment ago is what I want to reiterate. He basically said exactly what I want to say, which is the Western world, the Western governments, and now the Canadian government cannot continue to bomb and kill people in the Middle East, and Muslims specifically, and not make a connection between the, you know, 20 years and 30 years of bombing the Middle East and what is happening on their land.
But, Mo, how do we get out of it? I mean, you've got the Islamic State taking over turf. You've got the terrorist organizations there who have targeted the U.S. and now Canada. How do we get out of this grip?
I might not know how to get out of it, but I will tell you, if we watch the history of the U.S. and the Western world interfering in civil wars around the world, which is exactly what is happening over there, bombing and military action in a civil war in a foreign country has never, ever, ever solved the problem.
Mo in St. Catharine, Ontario, in Canada. Mo, I appreciate your call as well. We're looking at a week in the news, gunfire in Canada's capital, Ebola in New York City, midterm push, airbags, the Ferguson grand jury, and a leak there on the autopsy. The fourth Ebola case in this country on Thursday, Dr. Craig Allen Spencer, who recently traveled to West Africa to work with Doctors Without Borders, tested positive for Ebola in New York City. His neighbor, Jermaine Edmond, worried.
It's a major concern. It's scary. So, you know, all we can do right now is kind of like pray on it and, you know, hope for the best.
Mayor de Blasio talking about it this morning on CNN. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo, as in response, saying when asked that he would ride the New York subway.
I'll ride any one of the three. We have to separate sometimes, Allison, the fear from the reality. Or the irrational fear, if you will, from the reality. And we have a dose of irrational fear. Now, being New Yorkers, a little anxiety can keep you safe, right? And it's not a bad thing.
A little anxiety New Yorkers can work with. Diane Brady, you're in New York. What's the response there that you're seeing today?
I think people are fairly calm. They do realize, again, this is somebody who came over from West Africa. It is a doctor who was directly treating Ebola patients. But I think it's another testament to the fact that I don't think the message around this has been very effective. You know, what from the CDC basically telling us this can be contained, only to have two nurses then pick it up, from this happening in New York. So I think it's certainly calm. It's one person. I think somebody said more Americans have been married to a Kardashian than have had Ebola. It's true. But the reality is that I think what's interesting is the fact that we seem a bit flat-footed when this happens.
And, of course, he came back from West Africa, yes, but he was a doctor. He came back, he didn't know, been out and around, been on subways, been out bowling.
That's what's surprising. You know, if you come back from treating Ebola patients, I think at this point you'd think that maybe there'd be a little bit more caution around how you act once you return to your home turf.
We've got Gustavo writing into us here on Facebook. We asked, what's your top story? And he said, probably that Ebola is not a very transmissible virus. Around 36,000 Americans will be killed by a different virus this winter. Get your flu vaccine. That thing spreads. It's deadly. That sort of let's chill out. Kelly, are steps being taken now, do you see, that will give Americans the confidence to get back into that mode of we can handle this or not? It's in the country's most populous city now.
Well, I think experience is a good teacher now, and people have been learning about this through the stories of these healthcare professionals who were, again, doing really good work taking care of the sick
and then
became sick themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think we're all learning more. Right now, on Capitol Hill, there is a continued pressure to try to get answers, to try to learn about how there can be a more effective response. And I think you pointing out the flu, far more people will die from the flu than Ebola inside the United States. And yet there is this fear. The fear is warranted in the sense that it's a very scary, deadly illness, but it is perhaps overplayed in the sense of how likely is it that any person is going to get it. Very, very remote, best as we know right now. Mm. And I have been with the doctors at the NIH, talked to them. They've been questioned again and again, is there any possibility this virus could become aerosolized and be then more easily transmitted? And they say the science just isn't there to suggest that, and that it is still very difficult to get. And so I think as people get more knowledge about it, the fear will kind of find its right and proper place. I think the habits of people who have gone to Africa and come back certainly will continue to get scrutiny. But at the same time, there is also, I think, a sense of remembering they were doing good work trying to help those who were sick. And so some of the criticism seems very harsh in the way that our society has gotten so coarse now in challenging the judgments of some of those who've been exposed to it.
I mean, many just want to see competence in handling this here in the U.S., but others still want to shut the border, and you've heard that on Capitol Hill. This was on Monday. Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, Tennessee, told here MSNBC she supports a travel ban from the countries in West Africa where there is Ebola.
We've been told time and again, if you want to get your arms around this Ebola outbreak, you have to isolate it, which is over there in West Africa, and you have to deal with it there. And we do need to go about restricting these visas or doing a quarantine there or having some kind of travel ban so that we can get our arms around it and coordinate the proper response.
But others with a big view saying here, no, do not do that. President of the World Bank talking with CNN, Jim Yong Kim, says, please, no travel ban.
It's extremely important not to isolate these three countries. One of the things as a medical doctor, and especially for Ebola, one of the greatest tools we have is to elicit what we call a travel history. Where have you been? And if we isolate these three countries, then we're going to lose the travel history because there's going to be such a temptation to lie about where you've been.
Kelly, what's the political half-life of Ebola right now, the political heat of it?
I actually thought it might have been on the sort of downside, but a new case sort of reinvigorates the debate. The president also has a new advisor, an Ebola resource coordinator in Ron Klain, who's
not to say
a political hand. And he is now having to face some of these issues with dealing with how to bring the response to an effective level. We are seeing a different handling than we did with the original cases involving the nurses based in Dallas, because a sort of SWAT team, to use just a relatable term, sent into New York would be dispatched to other places if there are other cases. So politically,
but I think, Kelly, that's what's interesting. I mean, that whole area of how long it took him to appoint, I call Mazar, I probably shouldn't, but I think that the fact that it took 2 weeks to basically understand that emotions were running high and to take action is what fascinates me about Washington right now. I would have thought he would have understood the need to get out there and really at least look to be addressing this, even if logic said you didn't need somebody like this.
Jack, what are you seeing in the whole Ebola saga now with the case in New York City, Jack?
Well, you know, some commentators have pointed out, and there's logic to it, that this is going to hurt recruitment of doctors for that part of the world. And the need there is just crying. The WHO says that the minimum doctor-patient ratio is 1 to 5,000. In Sierra Leone, it's 10 to 100,000. Liberia, on the eve of this wave, had 50 doctors in the whole country. Already 400 healers there have been stricken with it. Half have died, and it is discouraging people, this kind of record. Young men like this man in New York, Craig Spencer, to go out there. And this week, an official from Doctors Without Borders told NPR that he was flabbergasted, quote, at the lack of international response. He said, "This is not acceptable. You just cannot let a whole continent become infected and people die by hundreds. People are giving advice. They're talking, but we don't need advice. We need people on the ground doing the job like us. Please come." Unfortunately, the kind of publicity around this case discourages people from coming. And, of course, a travel ban would completely discourage them from coming.
You can go, but you can't come home.
Yeah, right.
Steve in Boston, you're on the air, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I just got one question. Everyone keeps telling you, don't worry, there's no way to catch it. It's real hard. You know, so what, he was on the subway, there's no way to get anything. Then why are they constantly burning everything the person owns after he dies, everything they own? If there's nothing to be afraid of.
You mean their clothes or things they may have touched?
Yeah, I mean, everything or anything in their houses, they destroy everything.
I suppose
that's
it's
after the illness is fully established.
Yes.
If you're not symptomatic, they say, and I'm not a doctor, I'm just passing on what we've been told.
But Steve's question, I think, there goes to if it's so hard to transmit it and it's got to be bodily fluids, why burn everything they owned? I guess there could be fluids or some remnant of fluid on the things that they owned, I guess. But that is a lot of caution to burn everything, if that, in fact, is the case.
Yes, better safe than sorry. It's interesting. I think actually Nigeria is the role model here, and we don't talk enough about it. That was, you know, in Lagos, a city of 21 million, mm-hmm. they were able to eliminate the threat, in part because the doctor basically saw somebody who looked like he had malaria, kept him in the hospital, didn't let him leave, didn't let him go bowling, go on a subway, et cetera, et cetera. Let's not forget, one of the nurses actually called CDC before she got on a plane to say, I have a fever and I just treated a man with Ebola. What do you think? And they said, you're good to go. So I think there's been a bit of a failure of actually, I think, being humble in the face of this, you know, epidemic. It may not be able to spread easily, but when it does, it certainly incites a lot of fear.
Shoshana is calling. Shoshana, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was watching the news last night, and the headlines were crisis, Ebola crisis in New York. And it just made me think that there's not an Ebola crisis. There's a gun violence crisis. There's people in America, the number of them living in poverty crisis. There's an education crisis. It just, it really doesn't sit well with me.
So don't put the word crisis here. We're going to watch that space. We're going to wish New York very well with this. And hope that they just nip it right there, and that's the last of it in New York City. And, hey, it would be great if that were the last of it nationally. And we talk for just a moment, to switch gears entirely, about Ferguson, Missouri, where we had this leak apparently out of the grand jury, Attorney General Holder, exasperated about it, sources are saying, that apparently indicated, Kelly, you tell me if we're going too far to report this, that in the shooting of Michael Brown, it was at very close range, that Brown was in part in the car. What's the meaning of this, Kelly? I don't know how closely you found it, but people are going to look to come to conclusions.
Well, and that's the risky part, conclusions before mm-hmm. all the information is out. On the one hand, people have been craving more information, more facts about what actually went on, and yet these selective leaks seem to be favorable to the officer, which carries its own sort of dynamic of how will the public respond to that. And what does it exactly tell us? A part of the injury indicated a shot to the hand. Could that have been, in some theories, going for the gun? Could it have been a hand raised to surrender? We don't know all of those details yet. And the process, which is supposed to be secret, is moving forward, and one wonders if these leaks are intended to sort of prepare the public for what they might hear later if, in fact, there are no charges brought against the officer involved. Many experts who look at the situation say it is unlikely that he would be charged. Even after all of the emotion that has gone on, this is a process that's supposed to be secret, and it has not been, and it could affect how people will respond to this. Even as they get more information, the emotions have not died down in Ferguson, Missouri, and this raises more questions, even as it's providing maybe a few new answers.
Is this a conditioning of public expectation here somehow? Let's go to New Orleans. And David, David in New Orleans, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, sir. Love your show. I want to just ask, when are people going to start to express about the fact that almost every one of these cases, everything seems to start with the police pursuing somebody, as we say in Louisiana, and I'm a civil rights lawyer, the reasonable person. Why is this police officer pursuing this person? And with Michael Brown, they're pursuing somebody who is walking on the street, pursuing him in a kind of an aggressive way. The person that was just recently shot, this security guard is running after this guy.
Yep.
These are the type of things that start. Nobody's addressing that the police need to be maybe completely trained about how the escalation starts and then the horrible things happen.
Hey, David, I take your point. You say you're a civil rights lawyer. What do you make of this leak, which suggests that the shooting, that at that point Michael Brown was not running away, is suggesting. We do not know the facts, but here's a leak that suggests maybe someone's deliberately wanting to say this, that he's right by the car, that he's partly in the car.
With the Michael Brown situation, we clearly know that there was a confrontation at the car, but from all accounts, there's a time when at some point Michael Brown leaves. Michael Brown is leaving and moving away. When somebody's moving away from a police officer or running away or walking away, why is it that they're still pursued with gunfire? So, the point is that if somebody is leaving and moving away from a police officer, that should be clearly somebody should not lose their life after that. But, you know, I understand that people, the whole getaway car and get that guy before he does damage to somebody else because he's very dangerous. Well, you know, it seems like African-American males that are running from the, and we all always train people, do not run from the police.
David, I think we've got it. Forgive me. I think we've got it right there. Jack Beatty, the choreography of what happened here, very important. There's a bigger choreography at the same time, as our caller, civil rights lawyer out of Louisiana, points out. But as Kelly says, there are still high tensions here, and everybody knows it. This leak is really gets your attention for its timing and the way it may be a play in itself.
Yes, and, you know, in addition to the autopsy leak, the Washington Post reported that 7 or 8 African-American witnesses have given testimony that is consistent with Officer Wilson's account, and none have spoken, quoting the Post, publicly out of fear for their safety. Now, if Officer Wilson is not indicted, those people are going to feel great pressure, moral pressure, to come forward and say, this is what we saw. And if this is correct, they saw things consistent with what the officer has said. That would be so important in calming tensions, because you're absolutely right. This is a potentially explosive moment.
I'll be glad to get out of the leak zone and into some real straightforward testimony here. Diane, can we just go to the markets and the economy for a minute? You're there in New York with Bloomberg Business Week. What are we seeing after that huge wobble in the markets? Something coming back here. Is calm returning? Or I see headlines today, Ebola jitters, rattle markets again. Where's the confidence, Diane?
I think it's interesting. I think that the Ebola clearly did have an impact on the market, probably not so much the New York case. But you look at the rest of the world right now, and that continues to have an impact. Europe looks like it's heading into its third recession. You know, the numbers out of Germany aren't so great. There's concern about China, certainly concern about the political instability. So the U.S. economy itself is actually looking pretty good. You know, unemployment is down. You know, wages are starting to edge up. But You see a lot of optimism within the U.S., but the reality is that the rest of the world, they buy our stuff, they make our stuff, and that's what has the markets really jittery, I think.
Boy, one Japanese airbag maker, surely not very happy this week, Takata, that millions and millions of airbags going back there. In other news this week, President Obama cast his midterm ballot early in Chicago on Monday. He voted next to a young woman, Aya Cooper, whose boyfriend walked by and said jokingly to the President of the United States, "Don't touch my girlfriend." Here's the president and the girlfriend responding.
I really wasn't planning on it.
I am sorry. Please
excuse me. There's an example of a brother just embarrassing you for no reason.
Embarrassing.
Just embarrassing, she says. Renee Zellweger's face in the news. Plastic surgery, the right look? Should we even ask? Access Hollywood's Billy Bush and Brian Safi went back and forth.
I think she looks fantastic.
Yeah, but not Renee.
But still pretty good.
But not Renee.
You know what? I give up.
You just can't get away from it. Ben Bradley, famed Washington-era Washington Post editor, Watergate-era Washington Post editor, died at 93 this week. In 2006, he gave an interview to Jim Lehrer, explained what got him going.
It changes your life, the pursuit of truth. And it, at least if you know that you have tried to find the truth and gone past the first apparent truth, towards the real truth, it's very exciting, I find.
The pursuit of truth is still just great to hear it and hear it in that gravelly voice, just terrific. There goes Ben Bradley. What an era. Diane Brady is with us from Bloomberg Business Week today from New York, senior editor and content chief there. Kelly O'Donnell, chief congressional correspondent for NBC News, with us from Washington. Jack Beatty is here. Kelly, take us to the midterms, if you would. What does it look like? Here we are. You know, we're getting down to short days now. Before the vote, a couple of weeks, what's it look like out there?
Well, I think it's very interesting that with so much other news that we've been talking about, the midterms have been in many ways crowded out of a lot of the public conversation in sort of the traditional general media. in my travels, being in places where these races are very competitive, boy, it's a different experience. People are bombarded by the ads. There is so much going on. And it's truly an important election. As someone who covers politics and campaigns and Congress, I always think these are important. This time is interesting because it could give us new leadership in the Senate. The current thinking based on polls and sort of the tempo of the campaign season is that Republicans could pick up enough seats to take over control of the Senate. It's hard to know exactly how that would affect the final 2 years of President Obama's term of office, but it would certainly change the narrative. It would change the priorities. It would be very, very interesting. We're also seeing the rise of the independents in a way that we haven't before, with some independent candidates in some key states making their states really more of the conversation than they typically would, talking about Kansas or South Dakota, not places that are usually the nail-biter type of results. But things have really reflected the dissatisfaction many people feel about Washington, about politics, about how things have been done. So there's sort of a moment for independents to step forward and say they want to be different. Now, that gets very difficult when you actually get to the governing part with the day-to-day operations of how does Congress actually work. But in the campaign season, that's a very attractive appeal.
This, of course, these are the days when the ads really roll out. A lot of billionaire money behind those on the right, on the left, Republicans, Democrats. It's all over this week. Joni Ernst, Republican candidate for Senate in Iowa, released another ad from a pig farm. Ernst is running against Democratic Rep Bruce Braley in one of the closest Senate races in the country. Here she is, surrounded by pigs.
Too many typical politicians, hogging, wasting, and full of, well, let's just say, bad ideas. It's time to stop spending money we don't have and balance the budget. I'm Joni Ernst. I approve this message because cleaning up the mess in Washington is going to take a whole lot of Iowa common sense.
Oink, oink, and off we go. In Kentucky, Democratic candidate for Senate Allison Lundgren-Grimes attacking Republican Senator Mitch McConnell. They're saying over economic issues in their Senate race. Here's her new ad from this week.
McConnell voted 17 times against raising the minimum wage, opposed tax credits for small businesses that create jobs, and even voted to end the payroll tax credit, costing families an extra $2,000 a year. Mitch McConnell, taking care of himself, hurting us.
Kelly, how does that race look? Everybody's watching Mitch McConnell. How's it look?
Well, at the moment, Mitch McConnell remains ahead in the polling. Allison Lundgren-Grimes has been able to stay fairly consistent in where she is polling, which is interesting because there's been so much attention on her and some criticism about her reluctance to her refusal at this point to say for whom she voted in 2008 and 2012. She's had a lot of help from the Clintons, long family ties there, and they've brought some energy and excitement to it. There is certainly a sense that Mitch McConnell is preparing for a transition of sorts, to use that term, to become the Republican leader and the majority leader of the Senate. So I think there's confidence among Republicans that he can win that race. It's certainly one of the most watched in the country. And certainly Allison Lundgren-Grimes, if she does not prevail this time, she has certainly set up a political future where her name recognition is now through the roof.
Mike in Framingham, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
You know, I'm blown away by this whole election coming up. I remember not 2 years ago at the previous election, the Republicans were beating the economy drum, It didn't matter anything else. Nothing else mattered. It always came back to the economy. Well, now the economy's doing well, and the credit can't be given to the president. It seems people are running from it. It can't be given to the Democrats. Look, name me one bill the Republicans passed. They spent the last 2 years trying to take away the Affordable Care Act. That actually turned out to be a good thing. It actually turned out to be beneficial to people. The world didn't come to an end. The CBO says it's actually creating jobs. All of this is coming to light, but yet the press keeps saying, and the media keeps saying, the Republicans are going to take the Senate. They got a lower approval ratings than the president has.
Well, it's still, but I guess when they say they're going to take it, they're going poll by poll, state by state, and I guess that's how it looks anyway, Mike. You may feel dismayed about that, and understandably, if you've got that perspective. But Diane, what about on the economy front, which Mike raises? Voters going to the polls, thinking about Republicans and Democrats. What's the economy say?
I think the economy isn't really resonating as much with people now because, you know, the jobs are coming back. The budget deficit, I think, is certainly something people care about. But you're seeing, it's interesting, there was a Pew study that found that the Republicans essentially lead on key issues like terrorist threats, immigration, health care. But the Democrats overall have a more positive image. So if you ask people more generally, you know, who do they like? You know, they have a favorable impression of the Democrats, but when they get down to their own particular representative, that's where you start getting into details like immigration, like how safe do I feel right now? And it seems to be tipping more toward the Republicans. Hard to tell in some cases, but, you know, I think it really is very much local.
Jack, I'll bring it to you, but here's a little bit from the president. He was talking with Al Sharpton on Monday on his radio show and talking about who in his own party is going to be supporting him, who won't, who'll be working with him. Here's the president.
We've got a tough map. A lot of the states that are contested this time are states that I didn't win. And so some of the candidates there, you know, it is difficult for them to have me in the state because the Republicans will use that to try to fan Republican turnout. The bottom line is, though, these are all folks who vote with me. They have supported my agenda in Congress.
Jack, there's the president taking the issue straight on, but will they be there in Congress for him?
You know, the Republican National Committee could have written that line of the president's. That's just what Scott Brown in New Hampshire, you know, the woman Joni Ernst in Iowa, on and on. That's just what they're saying. My opponent votes with the president 95, 93, 92% of the time, and the president just confirmed it. You know, there was news this week, Tom. A Democratic senator actually defended her vote on Obamacare. That would be Jean Shaheen in a debate against Scott Brown in New Hampshire. She said she was proud of the vote for bringing insurance to nearly 100,000 people in New Hampshire. But in a debate last night, she was asked, does she want the president to come and campaign? And she said, no, he's got enough to do. He's right where he belongs, down there in Washington, dealing with Ebola, dealing with ISIS. We don't need him to come up here in New Hampshire. It was a tightrope walk for her. You know, the national mood is just so against the Democrats. According to a recent poll, 64% of likely voters in competitive races think that, quote, things in the U.S. feel like they are out of control. That's not a good
Is it real? Is it a ginned up sensation, Jack? I mean, politicians are certainly jumping on a lot of these hot button issues out there, Ebola and more.
There's a lot to jump on. I mean, ISIS, you know, what we had over the, as we were talking over the summer, there was just one thing after another. It felt like the world was coming apart. And I think the voters are registering that. Now, whether that's the, certainly it's not the president's fault, but he hasn't calmed the waters. He has done nothing to instill confidence.
Keith in Atlanta, Georgia. Keith, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hey, Tom, I'm optimistic about some change in the last few years of the president's tenure. But whenever people call up, you just had a caller mention what name one bill that the Republicans have passed. I never heard anyone mention that no bills get to pass because none get to vote. Harry Reid just does not allow any up. So that's a theme that I hear one side of and never the other side.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure why.
Get some more votes going there. Keith, let me ask you, if it becomes an all-Republican Congress, you know, on the House and Senate, do you think it'll be better and how?
I hope it will be better because I hope the Republicans are not as stupid as they seem, that they will want to have progress, both for the nation and both for their party, how it will look going forward. But they've got to be allowed to have bills come to vote, or otherwise there is gridlock. And that's the story about the gridlock that no one really seems to talk about.
Keith in Atlanta, I appreciate your call. We're looking at this whole week in the news with Diane Brady, Kelly O'Donnell, and Jack Beatty. Kelly, what are people anticipating? If Congress goes Republican, what is it likely to mean about what gets done and what doesn't? It's only days now until the vote.
Well, I think it will change some of the level of responsibility. Republicans will have to show that they are going to accomplish some things. We hear from Speaker Boehner and his leadership frequently about the bills that are passed in the House but don't go anywhere in the Senate, as the caller was talking about. So Mitch McConnell would have to set an agenda that he can accomplish. Now, remember, because it's the Senate, and we're not talking about an anticipated big majority, a narrow majority, if that all comes to pass, as we've discussed, there's still going to have to be some work to try and build some consensus to get things passed through the Senate. So it will not dramatically change, because actually getting things through the Senate will still be a challenge, because Democrats can use some of the rights and the tactics that some of Republicans have been doing to slow things down. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But I think they will have to be willing to talk about what they are ready to affirmatively do, and not be in the case of just sort of fighting against the Democrats and trying to slow them down. It will really change the sort of tempo on the Hill, as well as I think it'll change what people are talking about.
One more on this front. Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma. Dwight is calling. Hi, Dwight, you're on.
Hi, yes. I was kind of interested, and I didn't know there was much national exposure to the governor's race in both Oklahoma and Kansas. You have two Tea Party governors in conservative states, but they seem to both be endangered.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about Canada here. How's it look in Oklahoma, Dwight? What's your sense of that race?
Well, it's kind of close. Mary Fallon's always had a couple points ahead of Joe Dornan, who's a conservative Democrat running. But it's basically been a neck-and-neck race for the last few months. And that's an unusual thing.
Yes, and of course, same in Kansas. It's a lot of the same dynamic there. We've talked a lot about that right here. Keep an eye on those. Austin, Texas. Bill, you're on.
Yes. The Republicans have proven the last few years that we really don't need a Congress by their actions.
What do you mean exactly, Bill?
Well, they don't want to vote on anything. They're opposed to everything that the administration puts forward, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent for the nation. They vote against the health care program, and yet the congressmen and the senators benefit by a federal program that they have.
Yeah, Bill, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Austin. Kelly, there we go. We've got Atlanta saying Harry Reid won't let votes go through. Austin, Texas, saying the Democrats won't let votes go. Is it true that nobody wants to vote anymore in Washington, Kelly?
Well, certainly once the midterm elections are over, that'll take some of the pressure off, because people don't want to take tough votes before the election. You know, the callers have, I think, input that suggests part of what is wrong, that there are impressions about who's responsible, who is to blame, and not everyone sees it in the same way. And it drives the two sides, I think, farther apart in many instances, because their supporters, their donors, the interest groups that align with them really don't want them to cooperate. We see that again and again. Now, there are a lot of things on Capitol Hill that get done in a bipartisan way that don't get attention. I shouldn't say a lot. There are some things that get done. From time to time, we see action where it may seem extraordinary that they're actually accomplishing something, when we've seen some of the fiscal deals and things like that. Yet, those compromises are often fraught with a lot of criticism, too. People are not happy with the result. So I think that members of Congress have to answer to their constituents and to the public about getting more done. That's really the theme in many of these races, about accountability and some of the frustration that is reflected in polls and is certainly the meat and potatoes of a lot of these campaigns, is about doing it differently. So if a 114th Congress can do a better job, I think the public would welcome that.
Jack?
And I think it's a testament to the failure of leadership, really, on the part of Obama. And he sounded like a technocrat, essentially, that clip that you had. And I think that that's been very interesting, just to see the fact that he's so logical and stepping back and saying, I don't get support here and there, as opposed to trying to really emotionally connect with Americans. And, you know, that would be very helpful, I think, to the Democrats at this point. But it's obviously not going to happen.
Jack, sit back with us for just a minute here on Ben Bradley. Died at 93 this week. Such a towering figure and personality, and just sense of go get it in the heart of the American press for so many years.
Yes, his favorite word apparently was impact. And boy, did the post under him have impact. Richard Nixon to his cabinet in May 1973. 50 years from now, Watergate will be a paragraph wrong. And the post is a big reason. He had an impact on the post. Circulation doubled under him. And an impact on journalism. His star reporters, Woodward and Bernstein, you know, drew a whole generation of people into
journalism. Me included. Is that growling bite of Ben Bradley still out there, Jack?
Let's hope so. I mean, my gosh, what we all owe to people like that, to investigative reporting, we need it, we have to have it, and he's a model of it.
And to the editors that drive it, yes, indeed, we need them. Diane Brady, do some of that for us, will you? Do a little Ben Bradley for us out of New York. It's great having
you
here. We appreciate it. Senior editor and content chief at Bloomberg Businessweek. Go get him, Diane. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Kelly O'Donnell, Chief Congressional Correspondent for NBC News. Wonderful to have you. Thank you, Kelly.
Good to be with you.
And Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.